This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Last weekend, a Salisbury man drove to a Washington, D.C. pizza restaurant. He didn't go to eat. He went, armed, to investigate claims of child sex trafficking that were alleged to have been connected to the Hillary Clinton campaign. This father of two daughters was not alone in believing this outrageous story. It has spread like wildfire on the internet and is just one example of the kind of fake news that is out there. Fake news used to be easy to spot. You could find it in bold headlines staring at you from tabloids and supermarket checkout lines. But today, the biggest purveyor of fake news is Facebook. They aren't publishing these falsehoods. Their users are posting and reposting these stories, sometimes believing them, sometimes merely passing on these ridiculous stories that others come to see as plausible. And this is happening all over social media. The line between fact and fiction has blurred to the point where a recent survey reveals that three-quarters of fake news consumers have been fooled by these stories. So where do they come from? How ubiquitous are they? And how can we discern what's true and what is not? To get a little help on that front, we're turning to Dr. Jonathan Albright, assistant professor of communications at Elon University. He is a contributor to the Huffington Post media blog and a reviewer for New Media and Society, among other publications. His research involves journalism, digital journalism rather, audience studies, and social news platforms. And he joins us from Elon University on an iPad. I can't get over this. Good morning and welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Good morning. And with us by phone is Brooke Binkowski, managing editor at Snopes.com, an internet reference source, attempting to give accurate information about urban legends, folklore, myths, rumors, and misinformation. She has written and produced for CNN, CBS, NPR, The Globe, and the Christian Science Monitor, among other publications. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And let me begin with you as the managing editor of Snopes.com. Individuals and media organizations have been using Snopes since it began in 1995 as a place to turn to substantiate facts and debunk rumors. Why should we trust you? How do you do what you do?
Well, okay. First of all, I'd like to start by saying that I don't necessarily think, how do I put this? I don't want to dig myself in, and it's a little early on this side
yes,
of the country. I don't necessarily want people to just sort of implicitly just trust us. I like the idea of trusting but verifying. We don't want to be the be-all, end-all. However, having said that, we do quite a lot of research on just about every story. There are some that we don't need to because they come from sites that we know only publish fake news. However, every other story we do a ton of research on, and we link and we give citations so that people can use us as a starting point for their own research, and then from there proceed and do whatever research they deem necessary.
I guess the genesis of my question is, you are able to, at least one hopes you are able to decipher what is real and what is not by doing a lot of research. And you're probably using some of the same tools that people who find these fake news stories on social media use to find these fake news stories. I don't think they're actively seeking out fake news. They're just seeking out information. So how do you find the real stuff out there or find out that that story is not true?
Well, sometimes it's extremely easy. Sometimes there's sites, like I said, that only publish fake news or propaganda or satire or what have you. So those are the good stories where we go, okay, you know, we can write this up in about 5 minutes. And then there's the harder ones. And those involve a lot of old-fashioned reporting, really. We do a lot of research. We do a lot of calling people to verify. We do a lot of going to courthouses to pull documents. We do Freedom of Information Act requests. We do as much research as we possibly can on any one issue. And some things are thornier than others, and you can see that reflected in our stories. If we can't, we have something called unproven, the unproven category. So, sometimes we're just as at a loss after we've done all the research as anybody else, but we at least have some context available for those who are confused, too.
Dr. Jonathan Albright, we've just gone through this election campaign cycle where there was an awful lot of fake misinformation and fake news out there about various candidates and campaigns. And it also seemed to be a campaign in which facts simply did not matter. When did you first start noticing the plethora of fake information or misinformation out there, and how did it begin?
Personally, I noticed it the last kind of week, maybe the first from the 1st of September to, you know, the election day, it seemed to increase quite a bit. So I noticed it everywhere. You know, it was on Twitter, it was on Facebook, and there was just a lot of, I think even more than fake news, there was a lot of debate about what was fake news. I think that that's kind of what started the conversation, just to begin with, is that, you know, people were arguing about what was legitimate, what was real, what was not, which almost turned up the volume on all the fake news. So I noticed it really, where it became really noticeable to me. And again, I'm not connected to a lot of the people that, you know, are arguing that maybe sources like the New York Times and sources like the Washington Post are, you know, are fake news. So, but I personally noticed it, you know, maybe the last 10 days of the election leading up to the voting day.
But that was fake news about the election and about the candidates. There's fake news out there about it, almost everything. Pizzagate is a good example of the kind of thing that might have appeared on those tabloid publications that I referred to in the beginning of the program in the supermarket checkout line 15 or 20 years ago. There may have been something probably not that outlandish, particularly about an individual being involved in a child sex ring, which is not true. Let me be very clear about that. But you may have seen that as a headline in one of those supermarket tabloids, and we would probably have laughed at it. We may have picked it up while we were waiting to check out and gone through it and think, isn't this silly? Now it seems a lot of people want to believe this outlandish stuff. Why? What's going on?
So for Pizzagate, you know, I did a little bit of research on that, and just so complicated. There's political things in there. There's a lot of religious themes. You know, what's concerning, I think, most about Pizzagate is that the people that were doing this research, on Reddit, you know, they very much believed, at least from what I can tell, you know, they're very committed to getting this out there and solving this to the point of almost fanaticism. So that, you know, Pizzagate was one of the scariest things I think I've ever seen on social media in terms of how deep it ran in various contexts. So yeah, it seems like fake news is getting more and more complicated to try to pick apart the facts and make sense of what's going on. And it's just getting extremely a lot of different players are at act, a lot of different sites, a lot of different platforms, and trying to trace it back to, you know, where it began is getting pretty hard.
Brooke Minkowski, before being with Snopes.com as their managing editor, you were in broadcasting and you worked at CNN and other news organizations. There was a time before CNN that some of us remember when there were only three networks, and maybe every town in the country had a morning and maybe an afternoon paper as well. And in those days, some of the real news that was out there simply wasn't reported. People did not report. News organizations did not report on John Kennedy's dalliances. Today, if a president is discovered having an affair, it isn't ignored. It is reported on. We have all of these 24-hour news channels, and yet, back in the day, we used to trust Walter Cronkite. Today, we don't trust anybody. We don't trust CNN. We don't trust CBS. We don't trust the New York Times. Why? Is it because as we report more of the truth, it destroys trust in government?
I wish I could say that, but there isn't. I mean, I'm going to take a very dim view of the media in general, and I don't mean to be one of those people piling onto the media. I just can tell you from somebody who has worked within the media for a very long time that is a major, major part of the issue. And that's because public trust is eroding in the media because of the cost-cutting measures that media across the board has taken place. They've slashed newsroom budgets. They've slashed newsrooms completely. I mean, when I left, I don't know, whatever my last job was before Snopes, you know, nothing existed. it was a broadcast NPR affiliate, actually. And even NPR was feeling these major budget shocks to the system. And you can't do the same amount and same quality of news with 10% of your staff that you did with a full staff 20 years before. It's impossible. And so people are going to make mistakes. That erodes public trust. People are going to start using clickbait and trying to use, you know, advertorials and various things of that nature to try to bring up revenues. That's not going to work to bring up public trust. I mean, all of these things over time, I think it started, gosh, I would say it started in 2000, 2001 or 2002, maybe even earlier than that. It just all these budgets started getting slashed, I think that one of the best ways to combat this fake news issue, or as I like to call it, propaganda, is to put more real news into the mix. That's my axe that I have to grind. I've been grinding it as loudly as I can because I think it's a really important issue. The first thing to go in a democracy or in any system that really has to deal with people being knowledgeable and understanding the world around them is almost inevitably the news media.
We will come back to that line of thought, the cutting of news staffs around the country in just a moment, because you're kind of playing into the whole pledge drive aspect of what's going on here at WFAE today. That's Brooke Binkowski, managing editor at Snopes.com. We're going to come back and talk more about this plethora of fake news in a moment on Charlotte Talks. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the plethora of fake news, where it comes from, how it is disseminated, why people believe it, etc., with Brooke Binkowski, managing editor of Snopes.com. That's a website that since 1995 has been trying to debunk myths and trying to find out facts, separate fact from fiction. She joins us by phone from L.A., where it's very early in the morning. Dr. Jonathan Albright's also with us. He's an assistant professor of communications at Elon University. When we talk about fake news and how it spreads and where it comes from, we often hear the words right wing and now alt-right in connection with fake news and misinformation. But doctor, are they the only ones engaging in this practice, or does the left do it too?
So I think that it's becoming both. I think this maybe it started with the right, but I feel like it's coming around back to the left side now, definitely, with Clinton stories and with kind of news that's being propagated about different actors on the right. So I feel like it's spreading, full circle. Fairly recently.
You've done some really interesting and very complicated and difficult studies of this. You have, if this is the right term, you have scrubbed the web. You've essentially done what Google does in its search engine. You've gone and crawled the web to find out all kinds of where things come from. And you've put that information into some sort of a pictorial or a graphic form of what it all looks like. And your graph shows the mainstream media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, network television, cable news, etc., surrounded by other small purveyors of information. What does this tell you about what kinds of outlets are having influence?
Well, it tells me that the, a lot of the mass, not all, but a lot of the larger, I would say, center to left-wing mass media are, isolated. They're not connecting. They're not linking out to the smaller right-wing sites. Yet the right-wing sites are linked in quite heavily to the left-wing media. I don't know what that means exactly for.
So what? Oh, wait a minute. You're saying that the news being reported by center and left. And I guess you're including network television and the major newspapers in center and left. Is that right?
So
you're saying that they are influenced. They are not influencing the news being reported on right wing generators of information, but that the right wing generators of information are influencing or having some sort of an impact on mainstream media.
Well, I think they're linking. It seems to me like the smaller right wing news sites are linking quite a bit more to sites like the New York Times and maybe the Washington Post because, they're picking up these stories and then spreading information about the stories or disagreement about the stories through the kind of media sphere on the right wing. So it's a interesting situation. So MIT did a project called Electome, and they found a similar similar result where the left wing kind of journalists are not linking or not connecting or not really even talking with the right-wing people. So it's an interesting disconnect between the two.
So would you say the end result of this is that the smaller, because there are thousands of them, maybe hundreds of thousands of them, tens of thousands at least, of the smaller right-wing purveyors of information that may or may not be true are overwhelming or have more greater influence than the mainstream media?
That's a tough question to answer. I don't know if it's greater influence, but they have greater presence for sure. At least in terms of the internet, they're more spread out. The news in the right is more diversified. It's more spread out, and I would almost say it's almost like a grassroots on the internet. It's a different type of structure for how they've set up their news system.
Now, you've also created a map of right-wing news sites that are involved in spreading what you call a micro-propaganda machine. The word propaganda has all kinds of connotations attached to it that are not necessarily good ones. Is there a similar cluster of left-wing sites doing the same thing?
That is a, you know, I've tried to get a list of smaller left-wing sites, and it's been actually hard to source because there, I mean, there's a few different reasons why that is, but I was told by another professor, I won't mention names right now, but you know, that basically these sites on the, for the, you know, those sites for the left wing are harder to find. They're kind of, they're hidden, they're buried in the internet. The users have a different type of technological skill set, I guess, the readers of the kind of far left sites. So it's been difficult to source a decent list of small left wing kind of extreme left sites. And I don't know, you know, there's a variety of reasons, but you know, to get the mass media is easier. But I'm having trouble actually. Yeah. You know, doing that, doing a, an equivalent list of what, you know, they would call fake news sites for the left.
Perhaps.
Go ahead.
No, that's just perhaps because I've been in media for 100 years now and have been in lots of different newsrooms and seen how people work in those newsrooms and have relationships with people who to whom this is terribly important, not only in their professional but their personal lives, of getting the story right and using journalistic standards to get the story right. It just blows my mind that people will believe stuff that they read that's been passed among people and shared through social media before they will believe the New York Times or CBS News or NBC News, not to pick one out of the hat here. And I understand why you may not believe everything that comes out of Fox or MSNBC because they are left and right by design. But everybody else seems to be in the middle. So, Brooke, does it, since you've been in journalism a long time, does it surprise you that people would rather believe what people have their friends have shared with them?
No, it doesn't. I mean, if you have a trusted friend who's sharing something or who tells you about a story, then you're just naturally inclined, I think, to want to believe it or to believe it without criticism or a critique because, you know, it's somebody that you trust. That's sort of human nature. You pass along information. And this has been something I really want to emphasize because I feel as though there's a lot of hand-wringing about fake news, which is, I think it's time to start calling it propaganda, honestly, because this isn't just fake news anymore. It's not just people making up stuff for a laugh. There is a specific, deliberate political intent between or behind what is being put out there, and it's coming from all sides. So I think that propaganda is probably what it should be known as now. However, I realize that's kind of an uphill Sisyphean battle, so I just wanted to put that out there.
Okay.
But one of the things that I do really think it's important to talk about is, you know, you're hearing a lot of people say things like, oh, well, they just believe this because they're just not very educated. Or, you know, they're stupid. They don't believe it because they're stupid. And I would argue that it's not people who are poorly educated or stupid. It's people who are looking for information and they've lost trust. That eroded trust I was talking about.
Well, let's talk about that. I understand that your point was earlier that you made was the fact that they have been cutting budgets in newsrooms, particularly not just at newspapers, although severely at newspapers around the country, but also in network television newsrooms.
Oh, yeah.
They've been doing it there, too. But there's more to this, and I was going to ask this question, but Kirby has emailed us with the same question I was going to ask. He says, for the past two decades, we've been told not to trust the mainstream media. It's even been referred to as the lamestream media. Did that create a trust void for this fake news to inhabit? Was this all part of a plan? Was it all part of a plan? Discredit the major sources and then start infiltrating with fake news.
I don't think it was part of a plan. I think it was a sort of crime of opportunity, if you will. I never think that anything is planned unless I have proof that it's planned. I usually just think it's kind of everything just kind of settled into place, and then some opportunist went, "Oh, hey, this is a really good idea. I can work with this." I think that it's basically the result of a perfect storm. There's the budget crises. There's the sort of attempt to use clickbait to bring revenues up. There's advertorials that are indistinguishable for all intents and purposes from editorials to get people to click more. You know, it's a lot of budget issues that translate into real world loss of faith.
Well, you bring up something that we haven't talked about yet. That is money. How much of the fake news that is being proliferated out there, and I don't know which one of you to ask this question of, but how much of it is based on ideology? And how much of it is based on, you know, eyeballs? If we get eyeballs, we can sell more advertising here.
I would say it's at least 80-20 money to ideology. I think that you've got, you know, market forces that transcend any kind of ideology at all. I mean, you've seen those strange interviews, those utterly bizarre interviews that I think BuzzFeed and New York Magazine and a few other places did with those Macedonian teenagers. You know, they don't have a lot to do. They're 16, 17, and bored, and they found that they could make $10,000, $30,000 a month in ads making these, you know, manufacturing fake news that just really get people going and gins them up. And basically they said, yeah, you know, I mean, after the election maybe we'll move, or after the election fear dies down, maybe we'll move on to natural health cures. People love natural health cures. We just make those up too. And I think that is really what it boils down to in most cases. However, I do think that there is that 20% that's motivated by ideology, and that is why I'm emphasizing propaganda as well as fake news.
Dr. Albright, as you made major graphic representations, after all your research into this, and you've made graphic representations of how this news spreads, how does it spread? How would you? Is there an easy way to describe it?
I think there is. You know, I think that from what I've seen, most of the fake news, or a lot of the fake news that I've looked at in my research, has come from these smaller websites. I haven't seen a whole lot that's actually published or kind of just originally put on Facebook. From what I've seen, it seems to me like people are coming out of Facebook and coming out of Twitter into these, you know, into the web and going to these websites and then kind of circling back around through the system. So, from what I can tell, most of the news seems to come from these smaller websites that post news articles, which then get posted or sent, say, or liked, and then show up on Facebook.
So Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg, who is the CEO and founder of Facebook, came out after the election with a promise to try to curb the amount of fake news being disseminated. But really, Facebook and Twitter aren't really – they're just platforms that people post. So how can Facebook policing itself really help? Can it help?
Is this for me? Because I have an answer.
Go ahead, Brooke.
I think that, and I worry, I'm very concerned that pointing the finger at Facebook and Google and Twitter and other social media platforms is going to take away attention and necessary attention from the very real problem, which is the dissemination of this fake news. It has little or nothing to do with the platforms that disseminate it and everything to do with where it's originating and why it's catching hold. And again, that goes back to my argument over whether or not it's created by an informational vacuum, and I believe it is. And I think that the only long-term response that will work, that will be effective at all, is to bring more newsrooms in, to fully staff newsrooms. And I realize that I'm coming from this sort of ideological standpoint of somebody who worked in news for 20 years. Mm. But this is truly the problem as I see it. I mean, again, people are going to grasp for information and news wherever they can find it. And so I think that while I do believe that cutting down on the sort of fake news that gets disseminated is a good first step, I don't want people to say, okay, well, we're done here. We've taken the appropriate steps, and I don't know what else we can do, because there's always more that can be done, and this runs the risk of being a Band-Aid to a much deeper problem.
People have lost trust in modern-day America, and perhaps modern-day world, in institutions. We don't trust the church anymore. We don't trust the government anymore. We don't trust the police. We don't trust the media. We don't trust journalism. We don't trust news entities like newspapers, etc. How much of that has to do with the fact that if you watch a local television newscast, the only person bringing you the news who has to have a degree is the weatherman. I mean, yes, you can have people in the newsroom who have journalism degrees, but not everybody does, and not everybody has to. And Spencer emails, we are requiring licensing of doctors and attorneys and other professionals. Is it time to require licensing of journalists, at least at publications and networks? Would that be helpful? Would that raise trust?
No. Absolutely not. Not even a little bit. Because look at it this way. If you're suspicious of the government and the media and you think the government and the media are colluding to pull the wool over your eyes for some reason, you know, like say you're a chemtrail person and you think the government is spraying lithium into the atmosphere in order to keep the populace happy and stupid, you, of course you're not going to trust a journalist telling you that's not true if they're licensed by the government. I mean, if I sent you some of the emails we got on a daily basis, it would only take a few before you went, oh, okay, I see where you're coming from. I don't think that that should happen at all. And I also kind of want to push back against the idea that journalists need to have a specific degree or license, too. I mean, we're talking about field experience here. That's what journalists need to have, and curiosity and an open mind and a willingness to admit that they don't know the full story. And I think what's the biggest problem here, other than budget cuts, is that newsrooms are generally staffed by people who are of a certain ethnicity. They're mostly white. They're of a certain background. They're mostly middle class to upper middle class. There's not a lot of diversity of thought or diversity of opinion, and this is across the board. Some diversity in newsrooms, and I don't mean to downplay that at all, but there really, really needs to be more, because otherwise you're subtly disenfranchising an entire swaths of the population.
We're talking about fake news this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking today about fake news and the explosion of it all over the place. Bill emails, instead of calling these articles fake news or propaganda, why not call them what they are? Lies. We're talking about this with the Brooke Binkowski, who's managing editor of Snopes.com, and Dr. Jonathan Albright, assistant professor of communications at Elon University, who's done a considerable amount of research into how these fake stories spread. And you discovered, Doctor, something else that perhaps we haven't talked about yet today that's a little disturbing. We already know that people gravitate today toward things that reinforce their preconceived notions. So if you are conservative, you are more likely to watch Fox News than MSNBC and vice versa. You discovered that there are networks of trackers collecting user data from people who are drawn to these fake news sites, and then they use that information to tailor fake news content to an individual's lifestyle and ideology. Explain that.
So I think that when you come into any website or when you use the web, even with some ad trackers or ad tracking kind of preventing software like Adblock, I think that you know, you're essentially creating a trail. You everywhere you go, every website you visit, every app that you open, you're leaving some type of trail. And it's fairly easy to collect. I mean, this is essentially what the advertising model of the internet has been built on, is this kind of, is this cookies and tracking. But I think that it's getting sophisticated to the point now where it's starting to get into some type of predictive modeling or predictive forecasting. So that's really concerning, because, you know, as we buy things, as we go shopping, as we swipe our, you know, shopping loyalty cards, all this stuff is being collected essentially and pushed into, you know, these databases where people can look up our lifestyles and our habits and what sites we go to, and, you know, maybe even things like credit, and make quite a predictive model on you know, how we might vote or how we might see the world. So it's pretty concerning.
So just like when we go shopping for an item on the internet, we suddenly see ads for that item or items very similar to that item popping up wherever we go, you're also being fed more news that feeds what you've already searched for. Is that what you're saying?
It's kind of what I'm saying. Okay. It uses, I would say, the same system or the same template. I mean, they're just kind of basing that off of the same type of thing for shopping recommendations.
You wrote an article for Medium.com where you talked about a vast network of dubious news sites, most simple in design, many appearing to be made from the same website templates. These sites have created, you say, an ecosystem of real-time propaganda. They include viral hoax engines that can instantly shape public opinion through mass reaction to serious political topics and news events. This network, you say, is triggered on demand to spread false, hyper-based, and politically loaded information. This is all deliberate.
To a point, yeah, it's a coordinated system, you know, not unlike Twitter or Facebook. As people become outraged by things. You know, the traffic to these sites, they put up articles, and to some point, it's coordinated, or it's quite visibly something that is run as a machine. So, you know, once you have trackers and once you can get people onto these sites, you know, you can essentially almost manage traffic, or it's like a traffic light. So all these sites together kind of create this system of I call it a machine that essentially pushes out certain types of sentiment and helps to shape people's reactions to things like what happened in the election, all the kind of events.
In a democratic republic such as the United States, can you operate in a world like that?
I don't know. that's a tough question. I mean, I think that what we're getting into, or what's coming, is censorship, and that's scarier than fake news, in my opinion, because even the new Facebook tool, Facebook has experimented and is launching a tool that, you know, you can report fake news. So, and I think that it's in that same system of, if it's porn or if it's violence, you know, it's in that same kind of reporting tool. So, and it says you can essentially click on news now and report it as a fake news story. So we're headed into a scary direction.
Hmm. And this is also why I'm sort of, on my horse, charging with my message of more real news, because I don't want to go down that censorship territory. I really become physically uncomfortable at the idea of painting sites with a fake news brush, because I saw that list from I can't remember the site, Prop or Not or something like that, where they were putting together lists of known fake news purveyors, and a lot of them weren't fake news or propaganda. They were slanted. They were opposition, you know, as we would call it. If it was in another country, we'd say it was an opposition news outlet. And that shows that a lot of it was ideologically motivated, and that would just continue to be a problem and worsen if we start talking about fake news sites and singling out sites and doing that with impunity. I mean, I just don't think that it should work that way. I think really you have to just put more true, vetted information
Will it really matter? Because we're living now in a world where everybody distrusts everything and everything that is said. They even distrust you at Snopes.com. Oh, you've received emails where you've been told you have lost all credibility.
Oh, daily.
Now,
daily.
Okay. Now, over the weekend, Chris Matthews on Fox News asked the president-elect about Russian interference in our election, saying, "The Washington Post reported that the CIA has concluded that Russia intervened in the election to help you win the presidency. Your reaction?" And Donald Trump replied, "I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just another excuse. I don't believe it." What is the impact of that kind of reaction from a man who is soon to be president, of calling into question a perspective that most, if not all, U.S. intelligence organizations have suspected, and which the CIA has now confirmed? If the president calls into question the government that he runs, can that government operate?
Well, other countries are doing it across the world. I mean, it's just kind of, we've been living in a very lucky country for a long time. You know, if you look at what's going on, for example, in South Korea right now, there is a very similar thing happening, actually, and it's not just South Korea. So,
but we are not South Korea, and we are not a banana republic, and yet we're becoming one.
Yeah,
or
it seems
we're becoming one.
It does, and I don't like it, but other countries are able to live with it. So,
Dr. Albright, let me get your perspective on that.
This is a tricky. You just have to be have to be careful. I think that, you know, there's a lot going on, and I think that someone like Trump, I mean, he's used Twitter repeatedly to his tool of choice is Twitter. He's used Twitter to essentially disintermediate the media. He's cut them out of the equation. So he's gone straight to his followers. He's gone straight. I mean, which is in a way it's brilliant, because, you know, he doesn't have to deal with, he completely bypasses a lot of the media, and especially the media that is opposed to him ideologically. So I think that, it's just another example of cutting out the function of the media in reducing their ability to verify or fact check.
Well, Brooke has talked about the defunding of news organizations around the country, partly because of the changing paradigm of how news is being consumed by people. Newspapers have suffered the most, but certainly network television, and as you pointed out, at one point even NPR suffered from it, although they're recovering thanks to generous donations. The media has also kind of done it to itself. When you look at the 24-hour news cycle, there is this pressure to be the first to break a story. And if you break the story and you're ahead of the other guy by 30 seconds, that seems to mean something, at least in those newsrooms. You can't check your facts as well as you should, perhaps, if you're focused on breaking the story first. So how do you balance that out?
More fact checkers, less emphasis on that part of aspect of the culture. I remember that rush, you know, the adrenaline kicks in. Well, I don't just remember it. I mean, we sometimes have that at Snopes when we're on to something that's going to require big corrections.
But it's also the fact that on these 24-hour news channels, they're live 24 hours a day. So when something is breaking, they don't have all the facts. They simply don't. Does that lessen their credibility because they have to talk about this as it's happening, as opposed to the old days when newspapers could take some time, reflect on it, write on it, get all the facts straight, and then publish?
It is absolutely eroding their credibility. I mean, if you have nothing to say and yet you have four people on scene talking about it, then of course it's going to erode credibility. If you're putting out bad information because you jumped a gun, of course it's going to erode trust. I mean, that aspect of newsroom culture really has to be looked at. We're looking at a major, I think, overhaul of news media in the United States. I think that's the only thing that's going to be able to stop this sort of spread of fake news, and it's not going to be easy.
Go ahead, I'm sorry. Finish
your thought. I'm ranting. Go ahead.
Okay. Dr. Albright, you wrote in another article for Medium.com this article is headlined, "Data is the Real Post-Truth." And you start by quoting William Davy, an associate professor at the University of London, in an op-ed piece he wrote for the New York Times, in which he said, "We are in the middle of a transition from a society of facts to a society of data. During this interim, confusion abounds surrounding the exact status of knowledge and numbers in public life, exacerbating the sense that truth itself is being abandoned." It does feel that way, but why? Why are we explain what he's talking about there.
I think in a way you can, you know, what's happening now is, and this contributes to the reason why everyone, you know, no one can even agree to disagree anymore. So, you know, there's just so many ways to shape information. There's so many ways to present it. There's so many different channels that it's difficult for people to make sense of, you know, of what's happening, especially for things like breaking news and things that happen on Twitter and, you know, things that trend. So it's just becoming something where you can use statistics to some point to kind of present something very, you know, in a very slanted or very biased way on any end of the equation. So I think that what it comes down to is, you know, trying to get to the base of issues by looking at some of the raw data and trying to use methods like I've used with networks to present something that's less inherently biased is one of the ways, hopefully, you know, this can be tackled.
And you say something that's even probably the most troubling of all the things we've talked about in this conversation. You say that many journalists and news organizations are churning out news in response to the public rather than leading the way to inform them on the underlying issues. In the post-fact era, what's in the public interest seems to be the opposite of what the public is interested in.
Yes. Can I talk about this for a second?
Sure.
I'm so sorry. I must get this off my chest. This has been awful. The day that news organizations started tailoring their news stories based on demographics, which I believe started in the mid-2000s, it was the day that news started to really die an ugly, ugly death. That is absolutely wrong. It goes against what news should be, and it has caused major problems. I'm sorry. Go ahead now, Professor.
Oh, it's fine. Yeah. I mean, I just think that It is. People are distracted, and news. Especially with the election. News. They're reporting on what people are talking about on Twitter, and that's just. It seems crazy to me.
And they want to hear from you. News anchors want to hear from you while they're on television doing the news from you on Twitter. It's insane.
The worst.
Absolutely.
All right. So,
is there anything worse than listening to what somebody else is tweeting from the mouth of a news anchor? It's like the most boring thing I've ever heard in my life. I don't care. It's like man on the street interviews. Who cares? Unless it's something that affects them. But, you know, Twitter users could be anybody.
And with that, we have to stop. And we haven't even scratched the surface on this with Brooke Binkowski, managing editor of Snopes.com, and Dr. Jonathan Albright, assistant professor of communications at Elon University. Thank you both for the hour.